Hello and welcome to For Fact's Sake, a monthly podcast by the Center for Information Integrity in Africa, or CINIA for short. I'm Tebadi Motla. In this episode, we discuss issues that help combat misinformation and support informed decision-making. Misinformation is exploding everywhere, including in the coverage of the Israel-Gaza conflict. The first casualty of war is truth. This saying is attributed to Hiram Johnson, who was a prominent American senator from 1917 to 1945. It's often been used to indicate that during conflict and war, information is contested. Governments have used propaganda and information manipulation to legitimize their actions. They also use it to undermine their enemies and to suppress information about what they are doing. The news media is often caught in the crossfire between truth and falsehood and risk becoming complicit in misinformation narratives. This is also the case of media reporting on the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Critics have accused Israel of deliberate misinformation by questioning civilian deaths, by disputing the number of people killed, discrediting sources reporting on Palestinian death tolls, and also killing journalists who report on Israel's actions. In this episode of For Fact's Sake, we look at what is meant by genocide denialism. And in the second half of this show, what happens when the media gets their reporting wrong?
My name is William Shoki. I am a writer and editor, particularly editor-in-chief of Africa as a Country, and I am based in Cape Town, South Africa.
So, William, let's start with genocide denial. Early in the genocide, for example, we had Israel and its allies in the media denying blankly that they bombed a hospital. Now, genocide denial has taken on a different cloak. Can you describe it?
I think it helps to first describe the classic form in which genocide denial takes place, which is, as it's self-explanatory, which is to deny that a genocide is taking place, to deny the facts that people present as evidence for why genocide is taking place, and to assert otherwise, to say nothing is happening, look away, go on with life as normal. And that the modus operandi for genocidal regimes in the past has been to conceal the existence and operation of genocide, whether we're talking about the Nazis on the Holocaust, whether we're talking about the Turkish genocide of Armenians, whether we're talking about the genocide of the Herero and Nama. All of these regimes, no matter where you look, had tried to suppress knowledge or information about what they were doing. These actions, these genocidal actions, were often carried out in some form of some clandestine fashion so that they would not be found out. Whereas what's distinct about contemporary genocide, and it's not just Gaza, I should say, you know, this is something that begins in the era of mass media. And so starts with Rwanda in the mid-1990s, continues in Srebrenica and now carries over to Gaza, is that we have access to the most information we've ever had up until this point of history to corroborate the fact that genocide is taking place, to corroborate the fact that, before we even attach the label of genocide, to corroborate the fact that mass killing is happening. You know, we can all see it with our own eyes. And Gaza is particularly pronounced because the rise of high-speed internet and citizen journalism and digital communications platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, Instagram has meant that anyone who possesses a smartphone and an internet connection can broadcast to the world their experience. And so we have this overwhelming torrent of information that suggests to us that at minimum, scores of people are taking place. And so what that has meant then is that genocide denial takes on a very different register. Rather than denying this basic fact and asserting that actually people aren't dying, you have some people who might say this, who might say, for example, that the numbers from the Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health are inflated or whatever the case might be. You might have some people who deny that death to the scale that is being claimed is happening, but they will accept that death is happening. And what that means then is that genocide denial is not a straightforward denial of the facts, but rather a problematization of how those facts are presented to the world. So they'll say, well, exactly as I've just said now, how do you know that these numbers are reliable and accurate, considering the fact that the Ministry of Health in Gaza is run by Hamas and Hamas is designated as a terrorist organization by the Western world? How do you know that the images that we're seeing publicized on our screen haven't been doctored or haven't been tampered with, especially given the rise of, for example, artificial intelligence technologies? And so genocide denial doesn't really arrive as blunt denial. It comes cloaked in the language of skepticism or objectivity or media ethics. The tactic here is to cast doubt on the images, on the context, and the sources. So people no longer present themselves as deniers of the truth, but as custodians of the truth. They say, you know what? We're the ones who actually care about the truth because we want to make absolutely sure that what we are seeing here meets the criteria of genocide. And so I think there's something that's shifted in the media landscape for how genocide denial has happens and means that it's far more pernicious, it's far more subtle, it's harder to detect, and it's therefore harder to refute in the public sphere.
Does this type of genocide denialism delegitimize journalists in Gaza, those who are left?
Absolutely delegitimizes journalists in Gaza. I mean, what a lot of these genocide deniers first do then is take umbrage with the fact that Gazans count as journalists. One of the most common tactics you'll see is this effort to scrutinize the credentials of these journalists by pointing to previous associations. This journalist was a member of Hamas 5 years ago, or they had a job working for the United Nations Refugee Works Agency, et cetera, et cetera. They try to cast doubt on our trust in Gazan journalists as journalists is the first thing that they do. And then the second thing they do is they cast doubt on the integrity of the work. So they'll take issue with the fact that, you know, as was the case in this article that was published in this high circulation German tabloid Bild about Gaza-based journalist Anas Zayed Fteha, they say that, well, if you scrutinize the images that are being presented to you, you can see evidence of choreography and the fact that the photojournalist has asked his subjects to position themselves in X way, or the fact that he is emphasizing certain aspects of the frame and ignoring others means that somehow the photo that is finally presented to the world is not a true product. It's something that has been sort of shaped or manipulated in some way, is the second tactic that you usually see. And then the third tactic is to also scrutinize whichever media houses that these journalists are affiliated with. At present, the state of Israel is not permitting any international journalists from entering Gaza. And so the only operating international English language media house is Al Jazeera, given that Al Jazeera has had a base in Gaza for many years. And so they'll cast doubt on Al Jazeera as an organization, sort of accuse Al Jazeera of having ties to Hamas or accusing it of being foreign funded and influenced by the Qatari government, et cetera, et cetera. The point of all of this is to get us as an audience to not receive the information with full trust and belief that the information is reliable and accurate, right? It never arrives as a kind of fully throated delegitimization to sort of say that this journalist is completely untrustworthy or lacks complete credibility. It's always subtle. This is the key point. It always sort of plays devil's advocates and say, well, if you look at the record, how do you really know? How do you really know? It's all of these questions about how do you really know? And the point of this is to get us ourselves to start wondering and questioning in our own minds. And once that seed is planted, then it could spiral into fully fledged mistrust. And it's in that sense, it makes it very, very hard for ordinary people to combat this kind of delegitimization that happens in these very, very, very subtle forms.
Is this delegitimization a form of disinformation?
Yeah, so this is where it gets tricky because, I shy away from the word disinformation because I feel like increasingly disinformation has become something of a floating signifier that is wielded in our intensely polarized media and political landscape by both the left and the right, equally accusing the other side of disinformation. And so it's almost like a word that is thrown out there to silence conversation rather than to open it up. And so, for example, you'll have genocide deniers accusing Gazan journalists, the Ministry of Health in Gaza, and people who are sympathetic, not just to the Palestinian cause, but who are sympathetic to the plight, mass murder, and devastation of the Gazan people. They'll throw the word disinformation a lot, and they'll say that there's a lot of disinformation that is out there. The sources that people are using to defend the charge of genocide, how can you trust those sources? Those are sources that come from this unreliable stakeholder. And so I would turn it around and say that before we call it disinformation, because disinformation is now this word that has been emptied of its meaning, just given how it's weaponized by a lot of people as a cudgel to silence conversation. I would say rather than ask whether or not this is disinformation, it might be better to ask the question of what do we know? And what do we know as a matter of public record, as a matter of consensus? And whether we use the label disinformation, whether we use, in fact, arguably, whether we use the label genocide, even though I have written and I believe that it is a genocide, what they are trying to do is to get away on technicalities and on semantics to deflect responsibility. Because whether it is or isn't a genocide, whether it's 60,000 people, whether it's 50,000 people, whatever proportion of those numbers are men to combat age, males, whatever the case might be, Israel is committing war crimes. It is breaking international law. Before October 7, it has been subjugating and oppressing the Palestinian people for 75 years, and it must be held to account. And the more we become preoccupied with what language to use, what sources we can accurately cite, the more we concede territory to those people who are trying to get us to lose our confidence in what we are seeing with our very own eyes. Because before the mind attaches labels to what we are seeing, we can see that what is happening is wrong, it is unlawful, and it must be stopped.
With what we are seeing, how does this genocide denialism create cynicism amongst readers, even those who are compassionate towards Palestinians?
Yeah, it creates a lot of cynicism, like I said earlier, because it positions us as people who are consuming this information to mistrust how we are perceiving and processing reality. I think one of the strange things about the time in history that we are living in is that it is simultaneously a point in history where we've had no greater immediate access to information because it comes directly onto our feeds. It's live streamed, as people say. But despite this access to information, despite this ability to know intimately what is happening in places that are thousands and thousands of kilometers away from where we are, it almost in a sense, sharpens our sense of helplessness, because there is this vast gulf between how much we know and what we are seeing and what we can do to end it. Because try as we might to mobilize in our hundreds of thousands, as people have been doing since October 7, try as we might to put pressure on our political leaders, try as we might to hold the state of Israel and its allies to account, it hasn't achieved much. There is this heightened state of global consciousness, but the same degree of impunity. And it almost, in a sense, creates this feeling of what is it all for? If we're going to have all of this access information that we can't do much with, what is it all for? And so the cynicism, I think, takes root precisely because of the fact that most of us are already predisposed to feeling powerless, whether on this issue or on other issues that affect our daily lives. You know, Gaza isn't the only social political issue where we both have this well, this endless well of knowledge and information, but this deep inability to do anything about it. And so I think most people in their everyday lives are resigned to a sense of resignation, to say, well, you know, what can I do? If the United States government can't stop Israel, if people marching in their hundreds of thousands for close to 2 years can't stop Israel, you know, what can I do? And if you ask the question, what can I do? And you see this coming out and you say, well, and then you start to hear the genocide deniers get in your head and you say, well, surely if it really was a genocide, there would be much more global condemnation. Maybe the fact that there isn't suggests that the people in power who we have sort of relinquished our power and relinquished our agency to, they must know better than me. And if they don't think anything bad is going on, then maybe nothing bad is happening, because we all saw how the world reacted to the Holocaust in the 1940s. They waged war over it. No one is waging war over Gaza. Not even Palestine's neighbors in the Middle East and the Arab world are waging war. So it can't be that bad, et cetera, et cetera. So the cynicism breeds root by destroying confidence, and not just confidence in what we are seeing, but in our own confidence to do something about it, not just on Gaza, but in every aspect of our lives.
What can the media do to challenge or respond to the denialism about the genocide in Gaza without amplifying this type of denialism?
It's a very good question. It's a very, very good question. And I'm glad you've asked it, because it's something that I've been thinking of myself. I think the basic thing is to find ways of cultivating media literacy again. I think that we are living in a period of history where literacy in general is just declining. And it's not just owing to inequality in resources for education, right? You know, literacy has been a problem, for example, in the third world, because we exist on the periphery of the global capitalist system. And so our states have less revenue to invest in things like education and are instead spending the money that they earn servicing debt to the IMF, right? So, you know, you can understand why countries like South Africa would face literacy problems, why our miseducated population would struggle with tasks such as reading for meaning and comprehension and so on and so forth, and would underperform in international benchmarks. But what you're increasingly starting to see is literacy problems in advanced capitalist countries who are at the center of the global capitalist system and who have no resource constraints, who invest, you know, generally, at least relatively better in their education systems than other countries can. And that is because of these technologies that are completely transforming the ways in which we consume information, that the more people are dependent on large language models such as ChatGPT or DeepSeek or Grok, the more they outsource their own abilities to think and to process information and to grapple with it to these technologies, the less they're able to process information themselves. And so increasingly, you're seeing that these technologies are undermining our own cognitive faculties as human beings across the board. And of course, that's going to have an effect on how people consume media. You know, one of the most maddening things that you see increasingly on a platform like X is whenever someone tweets something, is you'll see in the replies this incessant, instinctive almost inclination from people to ask Grok, right? Grok is this large language model developed by Elon Musk's XAI, and it's supposedly supposed to be this tool that allows you to find out more about whatever someone is saying, or to find out if whatever someone is saying is accurate. And people wrongly think that Grok is objective, if something such as objectivity even exists, and that the information that Grok relays back to you is trustworthy when it obviously isn't. And so each time people are on tweets, for example, asking Grok, whenever an article is tweeted, they say, at Grok, is this true? Or they ask the question in very loaded terms to get the answer that they want to confirm their pre-existing biases. And you see this especially with people who, defend the indefensible. And so you see an evaporating media literacy where people can't sit with information themselves and come to their own conclusions about whether something is true or not, conduct their own investigation. We're now increasingly caught in this habit of outsourcing that activity to large language models. And so I think what media organizations should do, at least those organizations that are still invested in the media and in journalism having some kernel of integrity, is to, in some way or another, invest in media literacy to help readers reclaim their own powers of understanding, their own powers of coming to their own conclusions, their own powers of interpreting and understanding the world. And if we don't do that, then I'm afraid that the media will no longer have a function, because who will need the media when you can just ask Grok or ask ChatGPT or ask Perplexity what is happening in the world? Whereas the function of the media once upon a time used to be to explain what was happening in the world, but with the trust and appreciation that readers and viewers would come to their own conclusions and not have those conclusions pre-decided for them.
That was William Shoki, the editor-in-chief of Africa is a Country. We are continuing our focus on the media and Gaza. In a time when the public is swamped with misinformation and fake news, news consumers don't know what to believe, and that certainly applies to news about Gaza. One would think they will rely on legacy media like the New York Times, the Guardian, and BBC to find the truth about the genocide as it unfolds. But it appears that many news consumers have trust issues with the media, including, and in some cases, especially the mainstream media. That's because the legacy media sometimes gets it wrong, and sometimes maybe out of bias, intimidation, or even fear. The BBC is one of the most trusted and relied upon news organizations, not only in the UK, but globally. But since the war on Gaza, they have had their credibility punctured. My colleague Charles Leonard, who has been a BBC fan for decades, is checking why this happened. He has even found a villain in this sad tale.
Free, free! Free, free! Free, free!
Right, but have you heard this one though? Death, death to the IDF! 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 Hell yeah, from the river to the sea, Palestine must be, will be, inshallah, it will be free!
The sound of the British punk duo Bob Villain. Their anti-Israel chant went out live during a BBC broadcast of the Glastonbury Music Festival on the 28th of June. Quickly, the broadcaster added an on-screen warning about what they called very strong and discriminatory language. it ignited political controversy. Politicians who had been quiet about the genocide in Gaza were up in arms. Prime Minister Keir Starmer called it hate speech and said that the BBC had questions to answer. The BBC said it should have done more and that it regretted not pulling the plug on the live broadcast. This comes after the furore over a documentary titled Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone. That film followed the lives of four young people living in the Gaza war zone. The BBC pulled it from its iPlayer video on demand service after it was reported that the film's narrator was the 14-year-old son of a technocrat in the Ministry of Agriculture in Gaza, run, of course, by Hamas. Alan Rusbridger, who was The Guardian's editor-in-chief for 20 years, now edits the political magazine Prospect. Early in July, he wrote about the BBC's tribulations under the headline, "The BBC claims impartiality over Gaza, but there's a conflict of interest at its heart." I recently interviewed Alan Rusbridger via Zoom. Your opening sentence was, "The BBC struggles to get anything right about Gaza."
Well, the most noise has been around two incidents. One was the performance at Glastonbury, where a rap duo started leading chants of the crowd of death, death to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. And the BBC got a lot of criticism for not cutting that. The second incident was a documentary using an innovative technique, which was to get children on the ground in Gaza to tell the story of what had been going on. And after the program went out, it turned out that one of the children was the son of a Hamas official, who was the deputy agriculture minister, I think. And that led to a big inquiry. So those are the two things that got the most noise. I think actually the worst thing was the failure of the BBC to put out a second film, which was also about Gaza.
He got injured. They shoot it at us at the operative room.
Israel has been killing the very people trying to keep the healthcare system alive, its doctors and medics, despite hospitals and healthcare workers being protected under international law.
Because I think by that stage they had bottled it, and the film went out on Channel 4 really with very little criticism, and I think the BBC completely overreacted.
As Israel has bombed Gaza, hundreds of Palestinian doctors and medics have refused to leave their hospitals.
We are in the theater, in the operating room. Full darkness, no water, no electricity. But we have a hero, surgeons, in Gaza.
So this was a film made by a production company called Basement Films, which is run by a former head of Channel 4 News. And it looked at the targeting of medical facilities inside Gaza and questioned whether the Israelis were in some way actually targeting doctors and medics. And it was a very painful watch. And according to the production company, that went through all the clearance hurdles within the BBC, all the compliance hurdles. It was ready to go. And the BBC said, "Oh, well, we've got this problem with the other documentary. We can't put it out till we've sorted that one out." And in the end, the production company claimed that they changed their story numerous times before finally saying, "Actually, we're not going to put it out at all."
I read somewhere that the BBC backed off by saying there will be a perception of partiality.
That was the phrase they used right at the end. It is true that the reporter on the film had been interviewed by the BBC and had sent some pretty punchy things about Israel, and not things that other people weren't saying, but she's clearly got a strong view of Israel. And the question that some people felt was, well, is it, if it meets all your compliance standards, does it matter if there are perceptions of partiality? You can either stand behind this film and say the film itself is balanced and accurate and impartial. But that's not, they didn't come out and say they had any problems with the film. They just said there were perceptions of partiality about the presenter of the film.
So, as you've mentioned, there was a major outrage about Bob Villain and their chant. But it seems, and this poor pun is not intended, but the real villain at the BBC seems to be a person called Robbie Gibb.
So Robbie Gibb was a BBC producer, left journalism, went into politics, ended up as the press secretary to Prime Minister Theresa May. He's quite frank about his politics. He says, look, I'm not a soppy centrist politician. I'm a hard right Thatcherite. That's who I am. And when he stopped being a press secretary, by a curious and rather opaque route, he was proposed by the government to sit on the board of the BBC. The government has a number of nominees on the BBC. Now that in itself is odd. There he was, Robbie Gibb, put onto the board. And not only that, but he was put onto the most crucial editorial committee. It was called the Editorial Standards and Guidelines Committee. Now, this is where the governance gets a bit wonky. You have to bear with me. But there are only five people on this committee. And when Gibb was there first, he was the only external journalist. So there were three internal people, the chairman, the director general, head of news, Robbie Gibb, and one other who had spent his life in the world of art. So a highly influential figure. Robbie Gibb had another life, which was in about 5 years ago. He headed a consortium to buy the Jewish Chronicle, which was Britain's oldest Jewish newspaper. But he never revealed who gave him the money. And to this day, nobody knows who actually owns the Jewish Chronicle. Robbie Gibb, until recently, was the name of as owner. And under his tenure as owner, the Jewish Chronicle changed from being an community paper reflecting the lives of Jewish people in Britain and became more or less, I think it would be fair to say, a cheerleader for the Likudnik government or coalition government of Bibi Netanyahu, to the extent that five of its columnists walked out and said this has just become propaganda, that this is no longer a paper we recognize. The regulator twice considered launching investigations into its standards and ethics. And it culminated with the editor that Robbie Gibb had chosen, Michael Jake Willis Simons, publishing a completely fabricated report, which it seems as though it was slid into the paper by Netanyahu's office. So here's a man who is anything but impartial on the subject of the Middle East, sitting in this crucial position on the central committee of the BBC, and should, in my view, have nothing at all to do with any decisions to do with the Middle East. If you're talking about perceptions of partiality, there's no question that Robbie Gibb fails that test. And the ads, when I wrote most recently about it, I rang up with BBC and said, as Robbie Gibb recused himself from discussions about Gaza and coverage, and they said, no, not at all. That is taken part in his writing the terms of reference for a review of the coverage. So the BBC, I think, has got itself into a bit of a hole on this subject. And seems to be losing friends all around.
More than 400 media and culture figures, including, I saw the latest numbers, 111 BBC staff members, they did so anonymously, signed a letter calling for Robbie Gibbs' resignation. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, I don't think you would ever resign, because he thinks it's everyone else's problem, not Gibbs. I think there is a problem, too. See, what's happened now is that there are various proxies, and they monitor every minute and second of the BBC's output, and had constructed very successfully, I would say, a narrative that says the BBC is biased against Israel and may even have a problem of being anti-Semitic. You know, that's a narrative that was built up over years. There is one that I know of, one media organization that does the opposite, that is a proxy for the Palestinians. And recently came out with a report saying the opposite, saying actually the BBC is biased in favor of Israel, and it's got no coverage at all. So that doesn't fit the narrative. So I don't know whether the chair, Sumian Shinan, who I think is an old friend of Robbie Gibbs, is sensitive to the widespread perception within the BBC, as evidenced by those anonymous signatories, that many people in the BBC feel very uneasy about Robbie Gibbs' role.
We also know how newsrooms work, especially in big organizations. When I was a younger man, worked at the South African Broadcasting Corporation. So if the big boss is clear about his bias, underlings with similar partiality will feel emboldened. So even if they do get rid or decide to remove Gibb, the other guys below who are also in prominent positions, but not as public as him, who will continue to give Israel favorable coverage. Is that a correct assumption to make?
Well, that is difficult to say. I mean, there are some excellent correspondents in the Middle East, to say, Jeremy Bowen, who cover that region and cover it very well. And it's difficult exactly to know. I don't know enough about BBC's leadership to know what other editorial bosses think. I think people are beginning to point to the fact that the Director General, Tim Davie, who is effectively editor-in-chief, has very slender journalistic experience himself. This came from a marketing background. If I was the Secretary of State for Arts, I would, I think, begin to look at the governance of BBC, because it's an enormous organization. It's got a budget of more than £3 billion. Enormous output. And the guy in charge is expected to sort of look after the whole sort of ship shape, running and finance of the BBC, as well as being answerable for all the programs. And I think underlying this anxiety about the BBC getting it wrong consistently on Gaza is a sense that the Director General hasn't got much editorial experience. So, you know, I'm sure you and I, we've worked in big newsrooms, we're used to coming under pressure. Certainly, when I was editing The Guardian, people leaning on you all the time, and you have to make a judgment, an editorial judgment. When, if you think you're getting it wrong, you have to be bold enough to say so. If you think you're getting it right, then you have to defend the organization. And I think those 111 signatories were people who sensed that the big bosses didn't have their back and weren't making those kinds of rational decisions.
Well, it's not blatantly lying, but repeating some of Israel's propaganda or giving prominence to the likes of Israel's ambassador to the UK, isn't that also seriously damaging to the BBC?
You had to go to Israeli official sources and you had to quote them. Your work shouldn't finish there, because if they're not telling the truth, then you have to unearth that and amplify that as well. So I think it's not just a question of who you go to and who you quote. It's whether you're being properly rigorous in interrogating everything you're being told on both sides.
In a time when there's a deluge of misinformation, fake news, and so on, news consumers don't always know what to believe. So We rely on legacy media. So how dangerous is this bias or accusations of bias at a respected public broadcaster like the BBC?
I think the role of a public broadcaster is to be down the middle and is to be strictly factual and to be trusted by both sides. So I think its role is highly important, which is why it's all the more dismaying to see it making mistakes, which then gives the haters of the BBC, and there are plenty of those, including people who hate it ideologically or people who regard it as commercial competition, to pile in. Over months and years, people just try to chip away at its credibility. Some of it, a tiny amount of it, I think is fair, but most of it is really not fair.
How can the BBC recover from this?
I think it would be good to look at the governance of the BBC, give it more independence from governments of whatever color should back off, and be grateful that they have a media outlet that is so trusted and is, by and large, works to very, very high standards of accuracy and ethics.
In these times of cynicism about the media in general, what lessons can other broadcasters or members of the legacy media learn from this predicament the BBC finds itself in?
Well, I think the BBC is in a unique position because of its funding and its legal obligations. You know, we live in a world in which billions of people now have the ability to punish, and you know, lots of studies are out there saying that people don't know who to believe about anything. And that should be a great opportunity for legacy media, because we ought to be able to say, here we are, we've got this toolkit for the truth, trust us. And I think the problem at the moment is that people look at the so-called toolkit and they say, we don't believe that. And a lot of journalists seem more interested in banging home their opinions and telling people what they ought to think. And as long as they're doing that, people are quite justified in saying, well, if that's what you call journalism, then thank you very much. I'm going to find my own sources of truths.
That's Prospect magazine's editor, Alan Rusbridger, speaking to Charles Leonard. That's all we have for you this month. You can explore more of Sinia's work at the website, CINIA.Africa. That is CINIA.Africa. There you can subscribe to our newsletter. Also, please follow Sinia on Instagram for regular updates. I'm Tebadi Motla. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.